Hello, I'm Peter J. Radomski. This is number 0391, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
There, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0391. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a look back to an interview from 2000 with actor Richard Hatch, who just recently passed away. Among other things, we talked about his early days as an actor on soaps in New York.
Most soap opera actors started in theater, and they continue to do theater at night. I mean, they're able to do both. I would run from all my children's set down to the East Village where I was doing my play, and it was great. I mean, you know, it wasn't like calling yourself an actor. You really were an actor because you were acting.
Andrew Donovan, author of Motivate Yourself, talks about taking advantage of this hibernating winter period to take stock in your life.
Really review the year that you've just had and ask yourself some really deep questions and use a journal or a device to record your answers. What did I do last year where I felt good about myself, where I felt really inspired or my life felt like it was working? And through a process of these sort of questions, which I do go through in my first section of the book, you know, what lights you up? Where do you feel you're making most contribution? When do you feel good about yourself? You begin the process of mining and understanding your core values.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter goes to Florida for John Grisham's latest legal thriller, The Whistler. So start tuning up. It's all happening soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0391 was comedian Peter J. Radomski, who's based in Montreal and often is found at the Comedy Nest. He also occasionally performs in the Big Apple, among other places. And you can find him on Twitter at Peter Standup. That's Peter Standup. Thank you very much, Peter, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. It's also heard on Patreon.com. And isn't it time you become a patron of the Stuff File program? To do so, go to patreon.com/thestufffileprogram and find out all about it. Now, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Police have charged a man with drunken driving and fighting with the officers who allegedly found him semi-conscious behind the wheel of a car while wearing pink lingerie. Investigators say 51-year-old Daniel Marchese was also exposing himself when University of Pittsburgh campus police arrived to find him in the running car. They say he was going in and out of consciousness in the car while he was sitting in the middle of the busy Center Avenue intersection in Oakland, Pennsylvania on Monday afternoon. Police say Marchese was also wearing pink lingerie under his sweatpants, which were partially off. Police say they found an open bottle of whiskey and two guns in the car, and that Marchese kicked, yelled expletives at the officers, and threatened them by saying, "Just wait till I get my AK." As for the car Marchese was driving, officials say it had been stolen earlier in the day. Marchese is facing a dozen charges, including aggravated assault, indecent assault, open lewdness, DUI, and carrying a firearm without a license. You know, this guy seems to be getting ready to get his freak on in so many different ways. And all this amounts to is a buffet or a smorgasbord of charges. Yeah. Six officials in central China's Hubei province have been punished for dozing off in a meeting on how to motivate lazy bureaucrats, according to state media and the local government. Pictures of the sleeping officials have received widespread coverage in Chinese media over the past 2 days amid President Xi Jinping's sweeping crackdown on corruption, extravagance, and dereliction of duty. The Communist Party Discipline Bureau in Xiangyang City on Thursday named the mid-level officials and said they had to write self-criticisms and make public apologies. The Global Times said the officials had, ironically, been attending a meeting on how to motivate lazy and sluggish officials. Well then, considering the type of meeting they were in, it sounds like they made an effort by just showing up, right? Perhaps the onus should be on the leaders of the meeting for not being able to motivate the group. I mean, clearly, they're also falling asleep on the job, wouldn't you say? Yeah. Anyway, Stu Gale of Cochrane, Alberta, was working at his computer when he got an alert that someone logged into his laptop, which had been stolen from his car a couple of days before. The computer security and automation expert quickly logged in to the machine remotely, and the woman using it kept closing the pop-up saying he was there. Eventually, she went to the bathroom, and I went through her profile, he says. She had logged into Facebook. I went through and got her phone numbers and friends list. When the woman got back from the bathroom and saw what he was doing, she quickly shut the computer down, but he still could talk to her. I sent a text to all of her numbers saying, I'll go to the RCMP and I'll make you famous. Well, he did go to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and the woman, who saw she was getting famous on the local Facebook group where Gail had posted her photos, shut down her Facebook account. The police had no comment. I'm realistic, Gail says. I'm not going to see that computer again, but at least I got some comic relief. Well, you know, I like his spirit, but I've got one quick question. Remember when computer security experts, which he claims to be, were smart enough to have a power-up password on their laptops? Just asking. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest, or first segment anyway, here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Pennsylvania woman died after her arm got caught in the door of a clothing drop-off box while she was apparently removing bags from the container, and she was left dangling with her feet off the ground. 56-year-old Judith Permar was standing on a step stool when it collapsed, breaking her arms and wrists and trapping her in the donation box. She was fishing bags out, and the ladder she was standing on gave way, and she couldn't get her hand loose, said Mount Carmel Police Chief Brian Hollenbush. She died from blunt force trauma and hypothermia, according to the county coroner. It was minus 6 degrees Celsius out that night. Bags with clothes and shoes that had been pulled from the bin were on the ground. The woman's black Hummer was nearby with the engine still running. It wasn't something that I would expect to be seeing, the police chief said when asked about items being removed from the donation bin. By the way, Chief Hollenbush told the Philadelphia Inquirer that police had received a report of a woman also driving a black Hummer, removing items from the bin back in November. So there is a pattern. Perhaps she needed the items to get gas money for her Hummer. You know, those really do drink a lot of petrol, they do. This could be the story of just pure greed, or it could actually be a classic case of the Darwin file, because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Yeah, I'm going with greed. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first segment here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to look back once again to an interview with someone we recently lost. Actor Richard Hatch died earlier this month at the age of 71. He was best known for playing Captain Apollo on the original Battlestar Galactica back in the late 70s. He also brought the new character of Tom Zarek, a terrorist turned politician, to life in the revival of Battlestar Galactica back in 2004. Well, it was 17 years ago, at the turn of the century, that I had the chance to spend some time talking with Richard. He was always an evangelist for the show and never gave up hope that it would be revived again, as you'll hear. But talking to him also gave me a chance to dig a little deeper into his acting days before he literally became a star in space. Here is just a little part of that interview now.
What I want to start off with, I want to talk about, because I first came to know you from your role on the Streets of San Francisco.
Right.
When you replaced Michael Douglas.
I came on there. It was the fifth and final year. Michael Douglas had just optioned One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and gotten it from his father, which he was producing. His father had had it for many, many years. And so he wanted to leave the show to produce that. And apparently, you know, they let him out of his contract because he took a lower salary, I believe, in lieu of having that extra year on his contract that he normally would have had to do. And that opened the door for me, and I came in there and did the show. And I always remember Michael coming back. He did the two-hour, you know, changeover episode where I come in and he leaves. And they had a big cake, and this clown was on the cake, and it had tears. Crying clown. And I asked somebody, well, what do the tears represent? And they said, well, every tear represents $1 million of profit that Michael's making from the film. So he obviously did very well with that, and that set his whole, you know, producing career out there. And then that led to making independent movies, and then led to his big career that he has now.
Was it difficult coming in as, you know, the second guy?
It is always, you know, when you go through a shakedown cruise of a series, for anybody who's ever done it, I mean, that first year, everybody's going crazy, you know, everybody's afraid to make a mistake, you know, everything's on the line, the expectations, the pressure, and it's enough to knock anybody off the block, and it bonds you, and the actors bond together under that fire. And once Michael left, I know he was very close to Carl Malden, and I think it was very, very hard to bring somebody in once that rhythm and style of the show had been set, and then an actor has to come in and not essentially replace somebody, but essentially come in and fill out a new role, but create a new partnership. And it doesn't happen overnight. It takes a couple years, like any show requires, in order to kind of develop a style and a sense of flow, and to do it in 1 year is almost impossible. And so it was a rough, rocky year for me, but I learned a lot. I love San Francisco, and I wish it had gone on for at least another year. I mean, it takes that second year for a series and for your role to basically kind of start to find a comfortable place.
Was there a conscious effort to make your role, the role that you played on that show, very different from the role that Michael had played?
Well, I think they did. I mean, they talked to me, and you know, they started to make me in this kind of health food nut, you know? And, of course, Carl was totally opposite to that, so here I'm taking him into health food stores for a glass of carrot juice. And they were trying to find some comedy in that. And, you know, eventually I think that kind of got weeded out. And, you know, you start trying to do those things, and then you kind of let the natural rhythm of the two actors take over. And eventually, you know, it just kind of evolved into subtler differences, which just came as a result of me being different from Michael. And I think by the end of the season, I think our chemistry and our rhythm was beginning to work very well.
Now, in addition to The Streets of San Francisco, I guess we're getting the order a little bit wrong. Before that, you did All My Children?
I was the original Phil, which is, if you can think of, the original kids of All My Children included Susan Lucci, who everybody knows all over the world now, playing Erica, and then Karen Gorney, who went out to do Saturday Night Fever with John Travolta. Mm-hmm. And me, we were all the original children of All My Children back in 1970.
Wow, that does go back a few years.
Well, that was a great time. I mean, that was, for me, my first big break, my chance to earn some money as a professional actor and be able to take my mother and parents out to dinner and pay them back for all the loans I needed to survive. And it was a great time. I was doing a musical at night called Love Me, Love My Children, which ran off-Broadway and won an Obie Award. And so I really felt like I'd finally kind of achieved that that place that every struggling actor wants to get to, where he's taken seriously. So it was a great, you know, benchmark for me.
Where was home for you originally?
Beg your pardon?
Where was home for you originally?
My family, believe it or not, is all from Saskatchewan, Canada.
Oh, okay.
They're all Canadians. I was the first generation born here. And I think the first people from Canada went to Maryland, and then to Santa Monica. They had a beach house down there on Santa Monica Beach. And I was born in Santa Monica. So, I mean, essentially I've been a West Coast boy, although I went back to New York for 4 years to do All My Children, do plays, study acting, and start my career back there.
Well, see, this is where I'm going to show my prejudice, because I'm a soap fan.
Ah.
But I tend to believe that the New York soaps, which is one of the ones you were on, that the New York soaps have actors, and the L.A. soaps have television stars.
Well, you know, it was a big deal. I mean, when you first, New York actors were very revered at one time. If you said you were from New York, they made a big deal out of it. And then eventually, as television kind of really grew and everything seemed to be focusing out here, so many New York actors relocated, and then a lot of theater groups started to sprout up out here on the West Coast, and it became, you know, it kind of started to meld together, and it wasn't so much New York actors or West Coast actors, but I still think actors that are back in New York, maybe because, you know, the city of New York is so different. It's, you know, you life kind of hits you in the face back there. You walk down one street and you see tremendous poverty. There's gangs. There's violence, and then intermingled among that are wonderful hotels and restaurants, and life goes on. But you kind of have to deal with the, you know, the highs and lows of life in a very dramatic fashion. And I think you grow up faster. You kind of develop an edge, and I think the actors kind of have that quality that comes from the that kind of street smart experience that they get from growing up there.
But even as you mentioned, you said you were doing All My Children, and at the same time you were on Broadway, and you don't necessarily hear a lot of the L.A. soap stars doing stuff besides what they're doing on the soaps.
Well, that's true. I think being in New York, you really get acclimated to theater, and back there, I went back to New York with a theater group from L.A., about 30 actors and actresses. We lived in an empty ballet studio, lived on Campbell's soup. I think we had 1,000 cans of Campbell's soup that somebody whose family worked for Campbell's Soup gave us. And basically, I lived on that, had no money, slept on the floor, and essentially we were doing one-act plays, poetry readings, Shakespeare. And then eventually I was the first person, I think, to actually get something, and I got the soap opera, and thus began my career. But most soap opera actors started in theater, and they continue to do theater at night. I mean, they're able to do both. I would run from the All My Children set down to the East Village where I was doing my play, and it was great. I mean, you know, it wasn't like calling yourself an actor. You really were an actor because you were acting.
One of the things that's very exciting for sci-fi fans is that you're working hard to try and revive Battlestar Galactica, correct?
Well, I got asked to write the comic books a few years back, and they had heard that I had actually written a trilogy of stories and had gone to Universal to inquire about possibly doing a new Battlestar Galactica series, because the popularity was so great around the world because of the Sci-Fi Channel and syndication, very much like Star Trek. And I wrote the comic books, eventually got asked to write the books, and I decided to kind of throw out 1980, go back to the original premise of the show with the original characters, projected 20 years into the future, adding a new generation of our kids grown up in space. And we had a huge success. The book sold out in 5 seconds. Within 3 months, they had to do a reorder for that, a reprint. And I eventually said, you know, I really need to go to Universal and see if there's any serious way to bring this back. And they told me, basically, after an elaborate presentation, which we did for them, that they could see how successful the show had been and all that stuff, but they couldn't visualize how it might look like in the present day. And so I eventually went out and was going to do a very kind of low-budget little presentation, you know, with some graphics and voiceover and music. But eventually, through a lot of my friends and contacts in the industry, they kept coming up with a location and cameras and equipment, and I started writing and elaborating on the whole thing, and I started adding a bunch of live-action sequences and had a bunch of CGI guys come on board, and I eventually funded it out of my own credit card, and we built it into a really elaborate, almost movie-style trailer, extended trailer, about 4 or 5 minutes, with the first new footage and first new special effects for Battlestar in 20 years, and it came out incredible. I mean, we worked on it for about a year. We did the impossible. Nobody believed we could do it with the amount of money we were working with, and we had Academy Award winners coming on board to help us do some of the special effects and do some of the compositing and a whole bunch of things. It was amazing how many guys got into the industry because of Battlestar. So they came on board, helped us, and eventually we had it out there, and we had standing ovations everywhere we went. We had thousands of fans cheering for this, and I couldn't believe the response. And again, went back to Universal and said, you know something? You have no idea how many people out there love this show, And basically my pitch was the show Babylon 5 went off the air, Voyager went off the air, all the Star Trek shows went off the air. Battlestar is the only signature show with such a huge following out there that it only makes sense to bring it back, especially now with all the new revolutionary technology where you could develop and produce the show for less money than you did 20 years ago.
Now, a lot of times actors, especially when they're identified with a role like Captain Apollo, want to put that kind of thing behind them. You're embracing the idea of bringing the show back and being attached to the project again. You aren't worried about typecasting at all?
You know, it's funny. It doesn't matter what you do in this business, people typecast you. They typecast you because of age, because of this, because of that. You have no idea how everybody seems to be. They almost force it upon you because it's easier for them to know what to do with you. And so my thing is, I've done thousands of roles. I've acted all over the world. I've done movies. I've done television series, movies of the week. I've done so many things. And I got to a point where it really wasn't so much about being typecast as it was, you know, I wanted to do projects that I believed in. And I formed a company to start developing not only Battlestar, but many new series and projects that I'm actually in the process of filming right now, called The Great War of Magellan, which is a new sci-fi title, space adventure series, which I wrote and developed and have been filming for the past 9 months. And it's only one of many that we're going to develop. But the key was I wanted to be part of stories that really moved me. Acting is a wonderful craft. It's an art. Most people don't realize that. I love being challenged, but the waiting for somebody to invite you to be part of a project, you know, that many times is not even a project that you might want to do. I mean, I want to do things that inspire people, that make people really feel something. I mean, I love things that entertain, but I love projects that have something, some meaning to it, some meat to it, and you don't get that chance too often. So I started developing those projects myself. And I've always loved science fiction. I think it is the most spectacular genre there is because it combines the best of character and plot and story with the best of theoretical probabilities and possibilities where you can explore the unknown and go answer or attempt to answer maybe a lot of those questions that we all have about the world, about life, about human beings. And I love that genre. And Battlestar, that story is such a wonderful stories like Moses and the Israelites. It's that great epic journey to the stars to discover what's out there. And again, I mean, any kind of story to me that touches the heart, that uplifts people and makes them laugh, makes them cry, and makes them walk out of the theater, you know, feeling like life is worth living. I mean, Frank Capra, you know, it's a wonderful life. He produced many movies, but those movies showed us, you know, a slice of life, but they always left us with a glow in our heart. And those are the kind of projects I wanted to develop, and Battlestar is certainly one of those projects that I think brings the whole family together because it's something for the whole family. It's not just sci-fi. It's about people going up against incredible odds and having to be at their best to survive, and I think that creates great drama.
That was just a brief segment of a longer chat from 2000 with actor Richard Hatch. Richard passed away just last week in Los Angeles at the age of 71 after a battle with pancreatic cancer. He truly was a joy to talk to, and he had so much love for the profession of acting and the show that made him famous, that being Battlestar Galactica. And yes, after years of trying to get the show rebooted, he was part of its 5-year return starting in 2004. Stuff File program fans, you can hear the full hour-long chat with Richard Hatch by going to our Patreon page and becoming one of the select patrons of the show. Just go to patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show. capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
1, 2, 3. And still to come on the program, we will talk to the author of Motivate Yourself. Plus, Stuart Nullman is along with another edition of Book Banter. And we do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, so stick around for that. Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and also on Patreon.com. Isn't it time you become a patron of this show? Go to Patreon.com/TheStuffFileProgram. Okay, back to the Stuff File news. We keep hearing stories about people who feel the urge to take selfies everywhere, even in locations that are far from safe. We've shared stories about people taking selfies with wild animals behind them, leading to disastrous results. Well, this one, at least, doesn't involve a wild animal. A teenager was rushed to a hospital with serious injuries after being hit by a train while trying to take the perfect selfie, according to police in Florida. The incident occurred at around 5 p.m. over the cliff at Bluffs Park North. The Pensacola Police Department said that the 18-year-old woman is undergoing treatment in the hospital after she was struck by the train. Officer Nathaniel Aikens said that Julia Loriano of Destin and a friend, 20-year-old Leah Bateman of Pensacola, had been taking pictures of each other on and by the railroad tracks. Aikens said that Loriano was injured after she stood next to the tracks to take a picture of herself with an oncoming train in the background. However, the train hit Loriano as it passed and dragged her several feet before she fell off to the side onto some rocks. The train was southbound and was moving at about 40 miles per hour at the time of the crash. Yes, but did she at least get the selfie she wanted? Because, you know, to some people, that's what's really important. 11-year-old Girl Scout Charlotte McCourt of South Orange, New Jersey, saw her sales zoom recently when she posted brutally honest reviews of the Scout's cookies that she was selling, giving none of them a 10 and labeling some with dour descriptions. She was hoping to sell 300 boxes, but as of the end of January, had registered 16,430. For the record, the best cookie was, of course, the Samoa, rated 9, but longtime favorites like Trefoil was listed as boring, rated at 6, and Do-Si-Do was bland, rated at 5. The new Toffee-tastic was simply a bleak, flavorless, gluten-free wasteland, she said. Well, this puts the Girl Scouts in a quandary, doesn't it? I mean, Charlotte is basically trashing a lot of the merch publicly, but on the other hand, people are literally eating it up to the tune of over 16,000 boxes. It's not like the Girl Scouts can reprimand her and toss her out. I mean, she's a mini-marketing god. Yeah, well, they're going to have to keep her around. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump... Boy, it's still difficult to say that out loud, doesn't it? President Donald Trump has incurred the ire of many in the legal profession by referring to someone on the bench as a so-called judge. Now, while that may seem disrespectful to a lot of folks, let's take a look at the actions of a so-called judge. In January, Texas District Judge Patrick Garcia was charged with misdemeanor disorderly conduct after a dispute outside the courthouse in El Paso. An April trial date was set for Garcia, who was accused of giving the middle finger in public to another judge. Okay, let's make one thing perfectly clear. I've never given the finger to anyone, but I don't see it as being a chargeable offense. And if it really is a chargeable offense, then I know a few people who could probably get life with no chance of parole. Yeah. Meanwhile, a suspect pointing a gun attempted a robbery at a laundromat in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania in February, and he was not immediately identified. Now, the official reason for not initially identifying him was that, though detained, he had not yet been booked. Less likely, perhaps, police might have been trying to spare him embarrassment in that the laundromat's overnight clerk, a woman named Neu Moore Kantha, had simply taken his gun away from him and shot him 3 times. He was hospitalized in serious condition. You know, another example of gun control is for one to be able to control the gun they're actually using. Clearly, for this criminal, that is not the case. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we have a couple of stories under the heading of What Goes Around Comes Around. Number one, in January, 24-year-old Jesse Denton, driving a stolen truck, tried to flee police on Interstate 95 near Brunswick, Georgia, but accidentally crashed head-on into another vehicle. Seconds later, Denton was then fatally hit by another motorist as he ran across the highway to escape the crash scene. And number two, a 37-year-old British Columbia man did not die, but nearly bled out, before being heroically rescued following his parking rage blunder. Now, angered that another driver had parked too close to his own car, he grabbed a knife and stabbed a tire on the other vehicle with such force that he wound up slashing the main artery in his leg. Wow. Morons, meet karma. Karma, let me introduce you to two morons. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? It's winter. The days are shorter and people feel like hibernating. But Andrew Donovan says winter's chill offers advantages too good to miss. It's in winter that we can slow down and take the time to find ourselves, determine who we are and who we want to be, and put into motion short-term goals that will warm our hearts. Andrew is the author of Motivate Yourself, Get the Life You Want, Find Purpose, and Achieve Fulfillment. She is a leadership development specialist best known for her life-changing retreats that take place around the world. And she joins us on the line right now via Skype from the UK. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Peter. Lovely to be here.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, I'm a person who actually enjoys the winter, so I don't mind that it gets cold and the days are shorter. But for a lot of people, it's problematic. But it sounds like you found a way, as the saying goes, to turn lemons into lemonade.
That's a very good way of putting it. I mean, you know, the thing I think is that come the winter, people can feel quite flat, you know, particularly after Christmas, because Christmas, you know, is a great time of year to get family and friends reunited. They've spent a lot of money. And then they reach January and there's this sort of flatness. The days are closing in. Well, certainly in the UK, it's usually freezing and you're running out of light by about sort of 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And people get sad, literally. They get the seasonal disorder that we all suffer from with the lack of sunshine and light and vitamin D. And I think we're not dissimilar to the animals in that sense, that we need to hibernate and we need to sort of withdraw and actually take stock and take a long look at what we want to create for our next phase. So I personally think winter as the days are closing in, is a great time to withdraw into yourself, stand back, and start to examine, what do I really want to create in my life this year?
It sounds like what you're advocating here is a slow burn to the idea that a lot of people have at the beginning of the year, and that is coming up with ridiculous ideas for New Year's resolutions where they cram everything into, this is what I'm going to do starting January 1st. It sounds like you're taking a slower approach to that, which may be more attainable for more people.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. I wrote an article recently called New Year's Resolutions is for Losers. And although that was a bit confrontational as a headline, what I go on to say is that if January is the only time you make your New Year's resolutions, then you're pretty bound to fail, because planning begins maybe in January because it's a seasonal sort of let's start the new year. But actually the planning needs to go on throughout the year, and you ongoingly need to be connecting in with yourself and asking yourself, you know, is this the life I'm wanting? Am I on course? And checking in with yourself. New Year's resolutions on their own, you know, are not going to cut the mustard. For instance, you know, gyms seem to have a peak, don't they, in January.
Right.
And by the third or fourth week of January, all the members are sort of, you know, cried off again.
Okay, now, you're somebody, you've written the book, Motivate Yourself, Get the Life You Want, Find Purpose, and Achieve Fulfillment. One of the things I've always found, and I think it's the same with a lot of people, for instance, people have come to me over the years for advice, and I think I've given out great advice to people. The problem is, I can never give great advice, that great advice, to me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that even in your own life? I mean, the fact that you have this book, you do these retreats, you're great at it, but sometimes it's sometimes difficult to say, here's what I should do and here's why.
Yes, I mean, I think you always teach best what you most need to learn, as they say.
Yes, yes.
Having said that, I mean, I do eat my own dog food. I'm a strong believer. I started doing life planning and conscious sort of designing of my life, I suppose, you know, 25 years ago. And whenever I'm feeling lost or I've lost my course in some way, I always go back to, right, let's go back to the basics. And I do, you know, I talk about it in the book, the whole process of where do you begin? How do you take a look at your life? So, yes, I really do know what you're saying. But I, in terms of motivate yourself, a lot of the work I've recommended in there, I do myself.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you have done life-changing retreats that take place around the world. How did that begin for you, and what are the retreats like?
Well, my background, you know, in another life was started off teaching English literature to disengaged teenagers in some quite rough areas in London. And I think that's where I started to get in touch with my fundamental purpose, which is to make a contribution, to release potential, and to help people get the life they want. And to my surprise, I seem to have quite a lot of success with these, particularly teenage boys. And then when I finished that sort of chapter of my life, I went into management consulting, working with managers. And more recently, in the last sort of 10 years, I've been facilitating these retreats, mainly for chief executives. They invite me, it's usually word of mouth, and I work with them wherever they invite me. So I tend to be quite busy, so I like to think it probably works.
So do you have any tips that you can share with our audience? I would assume tip number one is get your book, Motivate Yourself, Get the Life You Want, Find Purpose, and Achieve Fulfillment. But once you've done that and gone through it, give us an idea of some of the things people can take away right now for their desire to make the most of the winter in the hibernation period.
Okay. One of the things in the hibernation period is to nurture yourself and create a setting where you feel that you actually can think about your life and think about what you want to create in your life. Not only pictures, as in, you know, I want a new house or I want a new car, but experiences you want. Excuse me. Because when you target experiential qualities rather than just the form of life, then I think you're onto a winner. So that brings me to my very first tip, which is really review the year that you've just had and ask yourself some really deep questions and use a journal or a device to record your answers. What did I do last year where I felt good about myself, where, you know, I felt really inspired, or my life felt like it was working? And through a process of these sort of questions, which I do go through in my first section of the book, you know, what lights you up? Where do you feel you're making most contribution? When do you feel good about yourself? You begin the process of mining and understanding your core values. And once you've come up with some of your core values, and it doesn't have to be many, but let's say one of your core values you realize is love. If you're the sort of guy who's running a busy business and you never come home and put your kids to bed, then you are not expressing love. And I meet a lot of these guys, they've got these complicated lives, and it suddenly dawns on them, you know, in their mid-50s, my God, I've missed my kids' teenage years, because they never really did the hard work of looking at what they actually want in their life. They're in the form of their life. So that's a very, very important thing. For instance, if one of the things I got at a very early stage in my first job was, I really like to make a contribution. And if I'm in a situation where I don't feel I'm making a contribution, I start to sort of die or wither a little bit. So like a plant, we've got to work out which is our best environment. And that's normally when we're expressing our core values. And I don't mean values you picked up from your parents. I don't mean inherited values. I don't mean sort of loyalty, honesty, integrity, because everyone buys into those generally. I mean the ones that are yours, the ones that really light you up.
It's interesting that you talk about looking back at the previous year and seeing what you liked about yourself and what made you happy, because I think for a lot of people, it's the goals, it's the destination, but they don't take a moment to look at the journey, and I think that's what you're describing now.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of putting it. You know, the journey, when I look back at some of my good achievements, you know, like writing a book, sometimes the journey of doing that is so much more valuable than the arrival point. You know, creating a brand new house, the painting, the decorating, the getting everything together is just as much fun as when it's all together and it's happened. And I think people underestimate that the quality of the journey, the living in the present, the living in the now, is so much more important than just targeting the arrival.
Well, I'm hoping that you have motivated people in the audience right now who probably might be in the hibernation stage right now, thinking about what they're going to do. Your book is called Motivate Yourself, Get the Life You Want, Find Purpose, and Achieve Fulfillment. You have a website that people can go to as well?
Yeah, I have a website, androdonovan.com, but also it's available on Amazon, amazon.co, and amazon.com, which is the international Amazon. So you can buy it on Kindle or, you know, or the paper copy. But the other thing I just wanted to mention is when you read the book, it will also help you rewire yourself in the second section, because it's all very well to talk about the things that you want in your life, but then we've got that negative inner self-talk that sometimes can undermine our best-made plans. And it's vital that you prepare yourself for those voices and you understand how to manage them and get them in control, because they will get in the way every time and sabotage you. So that's a very, very important part if you're reading the book.
A very important and vital point indeed. Andrew, thank you very, very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it, and good luck with the book.
Andrew Donovan, author of Motivate Yourself, Get the Life You Want, Find Purpose, and Achieve Fulfillment. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is number 0391, and you'll find links to Andrew's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. When you need to be treated by a doctor, would you rather see a physician who is happy or one who's stressed out? Think about that as you hear the results of a new survey of physicians. Recently, 14,000 doctors from a wide variety of specialties were surveyed to identify their levels of professional happiness. More than half of them said they feel burned out in their job. That's a 25% increase from just 4 years ago. The main reason for feeling burned out? Too many bureaucratic tasks. Let's be fair, we've been hearing a lot lately about how bureaucratic red tape affects job providers and even consumers. But when our physicians start listing it as their number one reason for being unhappy, that's especially troubling. Experts warn that doctors who have a reduced feeling of well-being and satisfaction can have lower concentration, empathy, and professionalism. And that can lead to problems making the right diagnosis and other medical errors. It's time to cut the red tape. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we all know Stuart is with us here on the program, but what is he talking about? Well, I'm sure it's a mystery. Hello, Stu.
Hello, Peter. It's still a mystery to me sometimes. But this edition of Book Banter, we look at a mystery, but more of a legal thriller, the latest book by... legal thriller extraordinaire writer John Grisham. His books, given bestsellers, but his latest book is called The Whistler, not to be confused with that old-time radio program, that thriller program from the 1940s,
a favorite of mine, by the way.
Not to be confused with that. This deals with whistleblowers. But you know what, if you need a good read right now, you can't beat John Grisham's latest legal thriller, The Whistler. Not the radio show, but it has everything you could want in a Grisham thriller. Detailed legal procedures, intrigue, skullduggery, corruption, and violence. But instead of Mississippi, where a good portion of his books take place, the state of Florida is used as its canvas. It takes place in the state capital of Tallahassee, where Lacey Stoltz and Hugo Hatch, investigators for the Florida Board of Judicial Conduct, or the BJC, they sound like co-anchors on a local news program, actually. They're on the case of State Judge Claudia McDover, who allegedly is in cahoots with local gangster Vaughn Dubose, and thanks to him, is taking copious amounts of bribe money so that the Tapakola tribe in Florida can build and operate a lucrative casino on the land that is part of their reservation. Now, thanks to a lot of information that is fed to them by a disbarred lawyer who goes under the name of Greg Myers, they find out, this... very salacious information about Judge McDover and how she's taking all these bribes and why she has such a very expensive lifestyle on a judge's salary. Now, however, while waiting to meet an informant with some vital information one late night at the Tapakola Reservation, the Prius car that Lacey and Hugo are in is violently rammed head-on by a large SUV, which seriously injures Lacey and kills Hugo. But with the evidence pointing that this was a setup and no accident, it gives Lacey a more steely resolve to rebound from her life-threatening injuries and finally get down to finding out the long trail of corruption and violence that is festering in this part of Florida. So fans of John Grisham will not be disappointed with The Whistler. Although it's a little slow-paced at the beginning, the narrative picks up speed as Lacey and Hugo get further into the investigation. And when the boom is finally lowered on the judge and Vaughn Dubose, the reader is practically on the edge of their seat, eagerly plowing through the final quarter of the book to see if justice is served in a satisfying manner. The Whistler is certainly an engrossing thriller about the dangers of being a whistleblower and investigating their claims that could bring down a large network of corruption that can at times infect the halls of justice.
So how do you compare it to other Grisham books? I know you've read a few of them.
Yeah, I read a few of them, and, you can't top his first two, which were Time to Kill and The Firm. Those are, you know, those are his two classics, and he'll always be remembered for those. But still, it's quite a good read, and, you know, it's if its purpose is to entertain you, you know, if you're reading, you know, during those hot summer days or those cold winter nights, it accomplishes that purpose really well.
So the book is entitled?
It's The Whistler, and it's by John Grisham, published by Doubleday, and it's $37.
And what else do you recommend in the genre, or do you just scoop yourself when I asked you that question earlier?
Well, I recommend a couple of, like an earlier John Grisham book and a later John Grisham book.
Okay.
The Chamber, which was published around 1994, deals with the issue of capital punishment. And, you know, the right of, not the right, but a lawyer who defends a family member who was accused of an anti-Semitic bombing incident in the 1960s, you know, and the basically the ethics of, you know, does someone deserve to die in the electric chair, or should that sentence be commuted? It was one of the more darker Grisham novels, and the more recent one is the one that was published before The Whistler, called Rogue Lawyer, which is sort of like takes a page off of Michael Connelly's Lincoln Lawyer books, and very likable character, very enjoyable book, and maybe one day, you know, Grisham will decide to take Rogue Lawyer, either write a few more books with this character, or maybe turn into a TV series. I mean, when I read the book, I knew it smacked of TV series.
Okay. So the current book is?
It's called The Whistler by yours truly, John Grisham. It's published by Doubleday, and it's $37.
And how can people find you? I'm assuming not in a courtroom.
No, thank God.
Okay.
You know, or in the halls of justice. But you could find me, you know, in the pages of the Montreal Times, published every week. Or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Stuart, thank you very much.
And I declare this case closed.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about into the home stretch here on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you. Here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also heard now on Patreon.com. That's Patreon.com. That's Patreon.com. And you know, the success of listener-supported shows like the Stuff File program is through your loyalty. So isn't it time you became a patron of this program? Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram to find out more. That's patreon.com/thestufffileprogram, and we thank you in advance for your patronage. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Anyway, moving right along, two New Brunswick men have been arrested after allegedly going through a McDonald's drive-thru on a couch. Miramichi police said an officer spotted the couch being towed behind an ATV at 3:19 in the drive-thru. That's 3:19, by the way, a.m. According to Corporal Laurie McEachran, and when the officer put on his lights, of course they took off, the four-wheeler did, with the sofa still attached. But he left his two passengers from the sofa at the drive-thru. The two passengers from the sofa or the couch or whatever you want to call it were intoxicated. The driver raced through the parking lot, across the highway, and onto the frozen Miramichi River, still towing the couch through much of his escape, she said. He got away, but they got the four-wheeler later on that day and seized the four-wheeler, so now they are just trying to locate the driver, she said. Two local men, aged 28 and 39, will face yet-to-be-determined charges. McEachran said it is illegal to tow a couch through a drive-thru, but the two men were wearing helmets. So obviously, safety was somewhat important, noted McEachran. Yeah. The fact that she had to say it is illegal to tow a couch through a drive-thru, it's like, does that need to be said or written down anywhere? Shouldn't that just be a given? I mean, honestly. And also, since I guess they were wearing helmets, they're not complete idiots. They're more like idiot adjacent. Which, by the way, brings us to the last story in this week's edition of the Stuff File program. Yes, boys and girls, it's time for that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time once again for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Authorities say a Northern Alabama man tried to get money from his grandmother by faking his own kidnapping. Lauderdale County Sheriff's Office investigator Lieutenant Brad Potts said 23-year-old Preston Kelly texted his grandmother a photo that appeared to show him bound and beaten in a wooded area in Tennessee. Authorities say Kelly told his grandmother to send $1,000 or else he would be killed. Potts says the woman contacted investigators who concluded that Kelly wasn't in Tennessee and the whole episode was a hoax. Kelly was arrested later that day in Lauderdale City and charged with first-degree extortion. And during questioning, Potts says Kelly maintained he had actually been kidnapped. A moron on so many levels, because why, oh why, would you fake your own kidnapping, asking for a ransom of only $1,000, because you think your grandmother is an idiot? And why would you continue to profess to the police that you were actually kidnapped, when to any rational person it would be clear that your plot was full of holes? One reason, and one reason only: your grandmother is smart, but genetics didn't help here because you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0391. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0391. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.